So it is a season of Hanukkah, just this time tomorrow. And of course, plenty to say as always. And we normally begin with the Dvar Halacha and then move into matters more of a thematic nature. As we'll see this evening, the two are very much intertwined. And we'll begin by making an observation, I believe we made in the past, and see where it leads us. And that is with regards to the unusual or outsized role that the concept of Hidur mitzvah, plays within Hanukkah. Every mitzvah has, or most mitzvahs have, an value, which is called Hidur mitzvah. It is a general concept. It is derived from the pasuk Zekeli va'anvehu. We see it with tzitzis and tefillin, arbaminim, and such like. But it just comes into its own on Hanukkah. It's just a different level altogether, and in fact more than one different level. So much so that many people are not aware that what they consider to be the basic mitzvah of lighting the menorah is actually level 3, called Mahadrin Min HaMahadrin. They might be scandalized if you told them that you can actually fulfill the basic mitzvah with much, much less, as the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, Kaf Aleph Amud Beis, outlines. The basic mitzvah, says the Gemara, is Ner Ish Ubeso. That is one light every night, just one for the entire family. There's 10 children there, a husband and wife, and it's just the one light, and that's the mitzvah. And you make a bracha, and you did a mitzvah. Then there is Mahadrin. And Mahadrin is Ner Lekol Echad Ve'echad. If there's 10 people at home, or 5 people at home, then you have 5 lights every night. Day 8 is no different than day 1. It is constant. That's called Mahadrin. It's already up a level. And finally, we get to Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, where the lights change with the days. As we know, the famous Machlokas Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, for Beis Hillel, like whom we paskin, we go up from 1 to 8. For Beis Shammai, go down from 8 to 1. Those are the 3 levels. And of course, the question that attracts the attention of the Mefarshim is, in a sense, you know, manishtana mitzvah zos mikol mitzvahs, that generally there's a concept of hidur mitzvah, but here there's mahadrin, and mahadrin can multiply the mitzvah manyfold. And that's before you get to mahadrin mina mahadrin. The words mahadrin mina mahadrin are borrowed quite liberally and applied to other contexts, but they do not purely exist outside of Hanukkah, mahadrin mina mahadrin. And the classic answer, or a classic answer that is given, is the reason why the idea of Hidur Mitzvah and Mahadrin is so much embedded in the Mitzvah of Hanukkah is because it was really what was behind the miracle of Hanukkah itself, that is to say, of the two miracles, the miracle with the oil, which clearly the menorah is associated with. And the reason why, as disappointing as it is, if you haven't heard it, but we have, there was no Tohar oil, all the oil was Tomei, and we were stuck. But the truth is, we were not really stuck. Because the worst case scenario, if we had not found the Tohar oil, we would have used Tomei oil, and it would have been with full sanction of the Halacha. The Halacha states that for something like lighting the menorah, a communal service within the Beis HaMikdash, Tuma Dechuya Betzibur. Tuma is set aside in the face of Avoda of Tzibor. Which means that had we not, number one, found that pure flask of oil, we would have used Tomei oil. Had it only lasted for one day, we would have used Tomei oil for the next 7 days. And therefore, the very fact that we went looking and we were not satisfied until we found that one flask of oil is already in itself a hidur mitzvah. We're not prepared to settle for the bidyevet. It's kosher, but the chashbonaim at that stage were looking for more than kosher, and therefore they did not use the other oil, which would have been acceptable. But it's important, I think, to pause at this moment and deal with a very interesting question. We know that all of the other oil, wherever it was in the Beis HaMikdash, was Tomei. Why was it Tomei? And the background to the question is, we say, V'timu kol hashmanim, yivanim nikvitzu alai, u'partzucham esbikt alai, v'timu kol hashmanim. The Greeks, they contaminated all of the oil, they made it tame. The raw fact is that at least on a din Torah level, a non-Jewish Greek could not make oil tame even if he tried all day, because a non-Jew does not transmit tumah in that way. He doesn't become tame, and he doesn't when he's alive, he doesn't transmit tumah. So how do we say that the Greeks betimu kol hashmanim? And before we get to how we reacted to the fact that they were metame, how could it happen in the first place? It could be, and some suggest, that this was a tumah derabanan. Derabanan at a certain point enacted a status of tumah for Gentiles because they're not careful with many things. On a deraisa level, on a dintero level, it doesn't exist, but it's there midrabanan. Perhaps that is what we mean when we say vitimu kol hashmanim. Their contact was metamed on a derabanan level, which further would then underscore the hidur mitzvah, because on a din Torah level, all the tomei oil was tahor. And still they went looking for oil that was tahor by all standards, even the midrabanan. That's the one, I would say, perhaps the mainstream understanding of vitimu kol hashmanim, but it's already a chiddush. Tumei derabanan. Fitting for a Yom Tov Derabanan. Others say, interestingly, and of course tragically, because I mean, it was a war, it could be that the way that the oil in the Beis HaMikdash became Tomei, we say they contaminated the oil, not directly, but they killed Jews in the Beis HaMikdash. If a Jew is deceased, he communicates and transmits Tumah to anyone and anything that shares the same roof. That's called Tumas Ohel. And therefore, it could be, and some suggest, that v'timu kol hashmanim is through killing at least one person there, and as far as we know, they did more than that. That itself had the effect of being metame the oil, min ha-Torah. Interestingly, if that is the case, then the way that the sealed flask of the oil of the Kohen Gadol made it okay was not just that it was sealed so that no one had used it. A sealed earthenware vessel is the only thing that is immune to Tumas Ohel. As the Pasuk says in Parshas Chukas, V'chokli patuach, Hashemin samid pasil alav. And therefore, it's specifically because it was sealed, it meant that it did not contract the Tumas Mace. That's the second possibility. Although, I must mention, there is a third possibility, which is to be found in the commentary of the Magen Avraham, who is famous, of course, as a commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, Magen Avraham. He also has a commentary on the Medrash Rabbah, which is called Zayis Ranan. And in the Perush Zayis Ranan, the Magen Avraham explains that vitimu kol hashmanim, when we say they contaminated the oil, it doesn't mean necessarily that they contaminated it in terms of the halachas of tumah and tahara through touching or lifting. They contaminated it because they used it for avodah zarah. They turned the Beis HaMikdash into a pagan site, and they used all the available oil. They poured it out for avodah zarah. At that point, it became forbidden, and that happens to be the case. It's something that has been used in the service of avodah zarah, there from that point is forbidden to be used for the Beis HaMikdash. And that's the Magen Avraham's understanding of Vitimu kol hashmanim. When you hear those words, don't think Tumah and Tahara, think disqualified because they contaminated it through using it for Avodah Zarah. If that approach is correct, then in fact it was no mere quote-unquote hidur to search for Tahar oil, because oil that has been used for Avodah Zarah, even b'dieved, even after the fact, even if there's no other oil available, cannot be used for the Beis HaMikdash. According to that approach, they had to search for oil that had not been used for Avodah Zarah. So, interestingly, the question as to if and how it was a hidur to look for Tahor oil ultimately depends on how you understand what we mean when we say that the Greeks were metame the oil in the first place. But, be that as it may, our minhag, and I've never seen anyone who does less than this, and most people are not aware that there is less than this, is to, on the day one, you light one, and from day two and onwards, we add the candles. And that leads us to our halachic discussion this evening, and that is how exactly to go about arranging the lights, and where do you start, once you get to knights two and onwards. And this, the answer to this question actually revolves around two issues, and we'll take them one by one. The first is a principle that is expressed in the Gemara in a number of places, and that is, when in doubt, always turn right. In the words of the Gemara, Kol peniyos she'atapone lo yehu ela liyamin. Whenever you turn to the right. Okay, assuming that this applies to a mitzvah like Hanukkah as well, and let's assume that it does, let us see how that expresses itself. And this is discussed by Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Beis Yosef. He quotes a response of the Maharik, Rabbi Yosef of Cologne. And the Maharik says it goes as follows. On day one, you put the one light all the way to the right. That's a good place to start. Put it all the way to the right. Fine. Which one do you light? There's only one to light. That's the one. From day two and onwards, as you begin to add candles, so you add them progressively to the left. And then what you do is the one that you make a bracha on and the one that you light first is the one that is most to the left. And the reason why is because if you start in the left, you are then able to turn to the right. That's how we fulfill the concept of turning to the right. By beginning with the left, we then turn to the right. And that is the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, interestingly, this minhag is mentioned prior to the Shulchan Aruch in the Shelas Tshuvas Trumas Hadeshen, one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, and it is one of the two customs that he quotes. This is the custom of Bnei Rhinus, those of the Rhineland. However, he does quote another custom, which is actually the mirror image of this. Not so much beginning on day one with the right and then adding to the left, starting and then turning to the right, but rather the opposite. On day one, you put it on the left, and then day two, you progressively add to the right, and literally the mirror image of the first minhag. The question, of course, is why would they have the opposing view? I mean, what is behind that? And this is the second minhag is, just to name it, is the minhag of Bnei Ostreich. Austria, I guess. And the Trumas Hadeshen says the thinking behind that minhag is that they also concur, of course, that you need to turn to the right. Their machlokus is, or their position is, you have to turn to the right straight away. I mean, that's what it means to turn to the right. You begin by going to the right. And because that's true, as soon as you have more than one candle, you're going to start with the one on the right. That being the case, and let's see how the mirror image of the first minhag is described, on day one, you put it all the way to the left. And then from day two and onwards, you begin to add more to the right. Because in so doing, when you make the bracha on the extra candle, on the new candle for that night, it's the rightmost. You start by turning to the right, even though in so doing, you will end up subsequently turning to the left from that point. So that's a kind of very interesting machlokus when we say that, and this is what it is reduced to, when we say that there's a value of turning to the right, that means you should start in a way that you will end up turning to the right for all your units, which is the first opinion of the Bnei Rhinus. Or do we say no, you begin by turning to the right, even though in so doing, all of your subsequent candles will be moving to the left. Do we go after the beginning or do we go after subsequent? Amazingly, they adduce a fascinating proof for this notion that that turning to the right means you start at the right, even though you will, from that point on, move left. Where is their proof? What's their precedence? How do you write in Lashon HaKodesh? Writing in Lashon HaKodesh begins with the right. It goes from right to left. Except, if it goes from right to left, why would writing in Lashon HaKodesh not follow the principle of turning to the right? It does. That's why you start at the right. Even though, in so doing, you will then, every single letter that you add is moving you further to the left. We see from there, say Bnei Ostreich, that the idea of turning to the right means that's your first turn is to the right. And if every subsequent move takes you to the left as a result of having started at the right, so be it. That's what it means. Interestingly, one can also adduce proof for this from the way, if we know the Mishnayos in Ezehu Mekoman, which we say just before Psukah Dezimra. I'm always mindful of something my father Zatzal said: if a person comes late for Psukah Dezimra, the first thing to be sacrificed are the korbanos. But the Mishnayos are there, and as we know in the third Mishnah, which has an application of blood on all four corners of the Mizbeach. So in the words of the Mishnah, you go up the ramp, which is on the south side, and then that brings him to southeast, meaning as he goes up the ramp, the first place he turns is to the right. Even though, when you think about it, if your first turn is to the right, your subsequent three turns will all be to the left until you get back to complete the circuit, go down to the ramp again. And yet we see from there that the emphasis of turning right is on the initial turn. Your first turn is right, even though all the other three turns will take you left. And therefore, says B'nai Ostreich, on the first night, you put it on the left-hand side, and then you add going to the right, so that in the subsequent nights, you'll start at the right, even though you'll then move left. Well, the minhag, because we only light one menorah, or each person lights one menorah, so we have to choose. And the minhag is certainly like the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah concurs, and the Arizal concurs, and that's certainly the minhag, as he said, to start on day one, to have it at the left, at the right, and then at subsequent nights to the left. Without getting too much into the details, but there is a fascinating response to the B'nai Ostreich's proof from writing Lashon HaKodesh. After all, what a place to go to demonstrate their position. And what do they say? You say we always start at the right, even though you then end up adding letters to the left. The Sefer Malbushe Yom Tov, which is quoted by later Poskim, says actually, from Lashon HaKodesh, you can prove the opposite. You can prove the way the Shulchan Aruch said it. And the reason why is because you begin your writing, you begin the sentence or the line at the right. But then when you add each individual letter, any letter that has a curve, says Malbushe Yom Tov, actually the way you write it is you start at the left and then turn to the right. If you think of any letter that has a body in that way, a nun, a kaf, a beis, a resh, a dalet, a yud, a vav, all of them, they all start, the micro turnings actually begin at the left and then curve round to the right. And that's really what we're doing. On day one, you start at the right. That's like starting the line. And then every night is another letter, so to speak. And the letters always themselves, even in Lashon HaKodesh, begin with the left to allow you to turn to the right. So that's, I don't think Hebrew letters will ever look the same again. They're subject to such a machlokas as to where to put the emphasis, how to look at them. But that is the minhag, and because it's the minhag that you always start every extra day from the left, the only other thing to take into account is that you should be sure that you are to the left of the whole thing, so that the first light that you meet is the one that you're going to light. We do not like to pass over candles in order to get to the one on the left. So you don't want to be to the right of the menorah and reach past all of them to get to the one you're going to light. You should be to the left of the menorah, and that should be the first one that you meet. So this is the question of right and left. As a parenthetical comment, but I can't help it because it's simply amazing, and it relates to the issue of the Mizbeach going up the right and turning, etc. The Poskim ask an interesting question with regards to someone who lights in a window, right there, which is actually mentioned in the Gemara, certainly if you're elevated, so you light in a window. And the question is, which side of the window should the menorah be on? The background to the question is as follows. When it comes to the doorway of a house, so that we know, the Gemara says that it should be to the left. And the reason why is because you've got your mezuzah to the right, and your menorah to the left, and that's a good way to be. And in fact, the follow-through for that is if for some reason the house doesn't have a mezuzah, it's new or whatever it is, then the menorah is actually put on the right. So we give primacy to the right, but if there's already a mezuzah, so then you want to be surrounded by mitzvahs, so you put the menorah on the left. That's doorways. What about windows? Everything is open. Seemingly, one would say, if we always lay emphasis to the right, and there is no mezuzah on a window, I mean, they haven't gotten there yet, so then you'd put the menorah on the right. That's what some people say. Says Reb Leib Mintzberg, you know where you put the menorah if you're lighting a new window? You put it in the middle. And why does he say that? Because the middle is the best place for it to be. The middle is the whole thing. It brings the whole thing together. The reason why you do not light, if you're lighting in a doorway, you don't put the menorah in the middle of the doorway, is because then no one could either enter or leave the house. You have to, so to speak, choose sides. And if you choose a side, so then the question is, do you choose the right side or the left side? But when it comes to a window, assuming that you will not be entering or exiting the house through the window, then you can choose the middle. And if you can choose the middle, middle is better than either of the sides. And why do I say this, says Reb Mintzberg? My proof is from the Mizbeach, from a Mishnah in Maseches Yuma. It's amazing to see the Achdus of Torah. Who would have thought that for a Mishnah in Yuma would help us out in the Halachos of Chanukah? Anything can help at any time. What does the Mishnah say? The Mishnah there, as we know, on Yom Kippur, it's the Kohen Gadol. At many junctures of the day, he's the only one doing the Avodah. All the other Kohanim, they're either not there or they're watching. But it's only the Kohen Gadol. And the Mishnah outlines many differences between how things were every day of the year and how they are on the special day of Yom Kippur. And one of the differences between them is that on every day of the year, says the Mishnah, the Kohanim would go up the right side of the ramp, make their circuit, and then come down the left side. But on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, he goes up the ramp, up the middle, up the center, and descends as well, using the center. And the point is, you can't do that every day because there's so many Kohanim. They can't go up and down in exactly the same place. They need to choose a side. If they choose a side for purposes of traffic, therefore they'll go up the right side and come down the left side. But the Kohen Gadol, no one's in his way because no one else is on the Mizbeach, and therefore there is nothing to stop him going up and down the ramp in the optimum way, which is the center, because that's the best. And therefore, says Reb Leib Mintzberg, you see from that Mishnah in Yuma, if you have to choose the side, you choose the right. But if you don't have to, you choose the middle. And in a window, therefore, that's his psak, to light in the middle. Very very wonderful connection there, made from Reb Leib Mintzberg. In terms of our discussion, we are actually halfway through, because we have discussed one of the issues in terms of how to light and where to start, namely turning right. But there is another question, and this is raised by the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon says, I concur with the Shulchan Aruch that the way you turn right is that you start at the left so that you can then move to the right. I concur with him on that, but I do not concur with the way that he says you should light the lights. Why not? Because according to the Shulchan Aruch, every night you light the new light. However, says Vilna Gaon, why would you light the new light? Let's not forget the setup. Let's not forget the halachic situation. It's only the original light through which you actually fulfill the mitzvah. All subsequent lights are mahadrin. They're hidur mitzvah. Now, hidur mitzvah beautifies the mitzvah, but it's not the mitzvah. And therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, if you want to start with the left, and we do, so that you could turn right, but you shouldn't have the new candle on the left, because then your bracha is on the hidur candle. You want your bracha to be on the actual mitzvah. And therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, the way to do it is, and this is the third and final approach, the way to do it is actually on night one, you put the first light, the only light, in the left side. And on subsequent nights, you keep on adding to the right. Why? Because you'll always start by lighting at the left, which means you'll always start with the original candle. You'll always start with the actual mitzvah candle and then go on to the hidur candles, as opposed to starting with the hidur candle themselves. So that's the opinion of the Gaon. It could be that those who follow the Gaon will light in that way. But the question is, how do we respond to what the Vilna Gaon said? Again, in one sentence, his objection to the minhag raised by the or recited by the Shulchan Aruch is that if you have the new candle on the left and you're starting on the left, so you make your bracha on the new candle, you're making a bracha on the hiddur mitzvah. You want to make a bracha on the actual mitzvah and then do your hiddur. Well, there are two quite different responses to this objection of the Vilna Gaon. The first comes from the Aruch HaShulchan, and it's a very interesting response. And that is, says Aruch HaShulchan, what is the Gaon saying? It's really the one candle is the mitzvah. All the additional candles are hiddur mitzvah. Says Aruch HaShulchan, but what that means is that you fulfill the mitzvah by lighting one light. It doesn't make a difference which light you light first. Whichever you light first, that is the mitzvah, and the others are hiddur. As if to say, there appears to be something of a dispute between the Vilna Gaon and the Aruch HaShulchan as to whether, where is there a particular place that the mitzvah light is. The Vilna Gaon clearly understands that all the positions have been established. Wherever you lit on light one, that's where the mitzvah light is. If you add other candles to the left, those aren't the mitzvah candle. It never moves from its place all the way at the right. In which case, if you start at one of the candles to the left, that's not the mitzvah candle. Whereas according to the Aruch HaShulchan, it's somewhat more, it's less static, it's more dynamic, in the sense that there is a mitzvah to light a light. As surely as, let's say you were only lighting one light every night, and you kept on moving it from one place to the other in the menorah. You can do that, and wherever it is, that's your light. And therefore, even as we add lights to the left, and you start at the left, it's true, last night there were three, and tonight there are four, but the additional candle, if that's the first one you lit, then that's your mitzvah light. And the original three then become your hiddur lights. And therefore, you're never in danger of making your bracha on the hiddur candle. By definition, the first one is the mitzvah, wherever it is. Well, that's the Aruch HaShulchan. It's a very interesting machlokas. I mean, there's a lot to think about now when you look at your menorah. Many questions to be answered. But there is another possibility which later Mefarshim, including those of our time, seem to be opening up. And it really will bring us back to ask the question, what is the meaning of moving from the basic mitzvah, which is one light, to Mahadrin, which is a number of lights, or Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, which is even more lights? What is behind that move? And here, in fact, there are one of two possibilities. We could say that, perhaps is the simpler way, the more intuitive way, that we're dealing with hiddur mitzvah, which means that the basic mitzvah is one, but if you light more than one, so then in addition to the one, which is the mitzvah, every candle beyond or after the first one are hiddur mitzvah candles. So the relationship of those other candles to this one is that the first one is the mitzvah and the subsequent candles are hiddur, and no more, and no less. That's one possibility. But there is another. And that is, it could be that when a person moves from the basic mitzvah of one to more than one, so his hiddur is that he has elected to move up, or to upgrade, we would say, to a mitzvah whereby, or way of doing the mitzvah, whereby the mitzvah is no longer performed just with one light, but actually it's performed with four, or five, or however many it is. That's the mitzvah. As if to say, the hiddur isn't so much in terms of adding onto the mitzvah, the hiddur is electing to move up to a more expanded version of the mitzvah. Now, you either can choose to do that or not. But if you do, the point is that all of those candles for the Mahadrin and Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin at that point will be mitzvah candles, because that's the mitzvah that you are Mahadr to perform. And they are all equal in that sense, which means if you're lighting five, you are Mahadr to light five, but the Hiddur is that you accept the mitzvah is to have all five. And once that's the case, then any one that you start with of those five is as much the mitzvah as the others. It's no longer a hidur candle relative to the original mitzvah candle. So this is the second approach. And seemingly, and some say, Rav Asher Weiss says this, Rav Bezalel Zolti Zatzal in the Mishnah Siyavitz, the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, also has this approach, that this seems to be the difference between the vision of the Vilna Gaon as opposed to the Shulchan Aruch. The Vilna Gaon understands that as you move from the basic mitzvah to Mahadrin, those additional candles are Hidur mitzvah candles. You are Mahadur the mitzvah. They all relate to candle number one as Hidur for that candle. And therefore, it says to Vilna Gaon, you don't want to light the Hidur candle first, you want to light the actual mitzvah candle first. That's the Vilna Gaon. Whereas, according to the Shulchan Aruch, once you move into more of those candles, it's a new mitzvah. And the mitzvah actually entails equally all of the candles that you're lighting for that night. And in fact, I believe there's room to add the following. We've mentioned this in the past in another setting. And that is, we need to consider the meaning of the word mehadrin and mehadrin mina mehadrin. We have made an assumption in explaining what that word means. And it is established, and there is a school of thought that way. When we hear the word mehadrin, we straight away relate that to the concept of hidur mitzvah. Mehadrin, people who are mehadur the mitzvahs, that's how the Rambam describes it. Vaha mehadrim es ha-mitzvahs, people that beautify mitzvahs. That's what it's all about. It's an aspect of hidur mitzvah. However, if you look at Rashi in his commentary to the words mehadrin, in his Perush and Masechet Shabbos, you'll get a surprise. Because Rashi does not explain the word mehadrin or mehadrim in a mehadrin as relating to hidur mitzvah. According to Rashi, the word mehadrin does not relate to hidur mitzvah. It does not relate to the Hebrew word hidur. In fact, mehadrin for Rashi is not itself even a Hebrew word. It's an Aramaic word. Mehadrin is Aramaic. And what does it mean in Aramaic? We know that Hadar in Aramaic is the equivalent of the Hebrew lachzor, to return. That's why when we make a siyum, we say Hadran Alach. Hadran Alach is nachzor lacha, we'll come back. Hadar means to return. Or to return can sometimes be to return to something or to pursue after something. Mechazer achar something, to pursue something. Rashi says, Mehadrin are mehadrin achar ha-mitzvahs. People who are in pursuit of mitzvahs. That's what mehadrin means. It's quite a statement. And it comes down, devolves ultimately just how you translate the word. And as we said, what language you even understand that it's in. According to Rashi, mehadrin is people that pursue mitzvahs. It's not hidur mitzvahs. Not in the normal sense at all. Very interesting. But if we finish Rashi's sentence, then it will lead us to a fascinating conclusion. If Rashi explains that the concept of mehadrin is people that pursue mitzvahs, and if you pursue mitzvahs, then you light this number of candles, and if you pursue more mitzvahs, you light this number of candles, if that is what waits for you, and you are characterized as someone who pursues mitzvahs, but what does it mean that you pursue mitzvahs? You're already doing a mitzvah. The basic mitzvah is just the one candle. Why are you called mehadrin if you're already doing a mitzvah? It must be that you are in pursuit of a higher level of mitzvah. And what that means is that when we say that for mehadrin you light more candles, it means that you have a different mitzvah. That's the point. It's not the same mitzvah plus hidur. It's a new mitzvah. And that really fits in with the way that the Mefarshim explained the position of the Shulchan Aruch, that as we go up from the basic mitzvah to Mahadrin, and from Mahadrin to Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, all the additional candles are equally part of the mitzvah because you've pursued a mitzvah, and this is it. This is your new mitzvah. The new mitzvah has five candles, not like the original one. And it changes from day to day, but they're all equally part of the mitzvah. And this, therefore, is the response to the Vilna Gaon's question on Shulchan Aruch, and that is why when we light the additional candle every night. The new candle, it is an equal partner in this respect to the mitzvah, as good a place to start as any, and in fact, according to the Shulchan Aruch, better, because it's the chiddush of this day, because yesterday was 3, but today is 4. So these are some of the halachic discussions, but as we say, very close to really the themes of Hanukkah. And in fact, I think there's room to say more. It could be that it relates to the very question of the meaning of the word Hanukkah itself. Why is this festival called Hanukkah? As we know, there are two classic directions or classic explanations of the word Hanukkah as the name of the festival. The first is rather more straightforward. Hanukkah comes from the word chinuch. It means to inaugurate, it means to initiate. And what is the point? The point is that the Beis HaMikdash had fallen into disuse, into disrepair, misuse in fact. And therefore, when they got it going again, they were mechanech, and that's Hanukkah. That's inaugurating. There is another perush, which is also mentioned in Rishonim, I believe it's in the Ran, well known, that Hanukkah is like a contracted form of two words, Chanu Kafhei. Hanukkah, it splits up into two, and one of those halves yet becomes a gematria, and that's Hanukkah. So Hanukkah is Chanu Kafhei. They rested on the 25th, which is the 25th of Kislev, which interestingly, although we won't discuss it, but this understanding of Hanukkah actually leads us into a fascinating question. And that is that if indeed we rested on the 25th of Kislev, then we made our way to the Hashanah, made their way to the Beis HaMikdash, and they lit the menorah. The menorah takes place just before the evening. It takes you into the next evening. If they rested on the 25th, that means that the first night that they actually lit the menorah was the night going to the 26th, which is interesting because it burnt for the next 8 days. But we actually start Hanukkah on the 25th, which is the evening before they actually lit the menorah themselves. That's an interesting question, which the Mefarshim discuss. But in any case, I believe that the ultimate meaning of Hanukkah is a combination of these two. As if to say, it is Hanukkah as dedication, but it is also Chanukah. And the reason why the two go together is because there's something about the situation here which perhaps we might otherwise take for granted, but we should not. And that is the inauguration of the Beis HaMikdash took place on the day that the battle ceased. I mean, the Hasmonean wars would yet continue, but at least that significant respite. So on the day that the battle ceased, that's when the menorah was lit. The reason why that should not be taken for granted is because the battle took place on the battlefield, and the inauguration took place in the Beis HaMikdash, which means they went from one to the other. But they could very easily have chosen not to go from one to the other, at least not that day. If we just imagine, and many things don't change, but all the more so in those times, the day the battle ends, everyone's exhausted, they could go home. There is the matter of rededicating the Beis HaMikdash. They can do that tomorrow or next week. One of the stunning aspects of the story is that they did not even wait a day. They did not allow the day to conclude without going to the Beis HaMikdash to inaugurate the menorah. That's how the day concluded. They were in battle until the morning or the afternoon and went straight to the Beis HaMikdash. The reason why I believe is because if they hadn't done that, then they were in danger of not fully justifying or validating their victory over the Greeks. Because, after all, what is the confrontation between Greece and Torah about, if not this very question, as to why is it important to be independent What do you make of it? What are your possibilities? What constitutes success? What constitutes victory itself? To have ended the day on the battlefield and just go home, from a certain point of view, would be a Greek definition of victory. Because that's what they would do. And if you subscribe to their definition of victory, so you have lost, even if, as you've defeated them. Because they have succeeded in getting you to adopt their lexicon and their definitions. And that's why the day did not end before giving a Jewish definition to what it means to be victorious. You have your freedom, what do you use it for? You have your political independence, autonomy, what do you use it for? For something higher. And therefore they went straight to the Beis HaMikdash. And that is why the mitzvah in subsequent generations with which we commemorate the war is also through lighting the menorah. That's an important point. Sometimes it's perhaps not so much understood that, especially as there's two mitzvahs on Hanukkah, there's the mitzvah of menorah and there's the mitzvah of Hallel. And as we know, there were two miracles at the time of Hanukkah. There was the miracle with the war and there was the miracle with the oil. And therefore, if there were two miracles and there are two mitzvahs, we then begin to make shiduchim. And we come to the conclusion that if there's a miracle with the oil and there's a mitzvah to light the menorah, so presumably that commemorates the miracle with the menorah. And then Hallel, I guess by default, commemorates the miracle with the war. But that's not so. And in fact, it can be demonstrated from the halacha that that's not so. Because as we know, although Hanukkah is a time-bound positive mitzvah, women generally are exempt. When it comes to Hanukkah, women are as obligated in the mitzvah as men are. A wife can light for the husband just like the husband can light for the wife. It's 100% the chatchila. Why is this mitzvah exceptional? As the Gemara explains, famous words, mipnei sha'af hein hayu ba'oso anes, because they were also involved in the miracle, either in a passive way or perhaps even actively through Yehudis, as is well known. She kind of got the whole thing going. And when you put that sentence together, we are saying that women were involved in the miracle, and that's why they're obligated to light the menorah. But no woman was involved in the miracle with the oil. When we say afin hoibos anes, women were involved in the miracle with the war. But that translates into an absolute obligation to light the menorah. What does that tell us about what the menorah commemorates? It commemorates the miracle with the war. So that's very interesting. Because if we ask, of all the ways to commemorate victory on the battlefield, why did Chazal choose to do so by celebrating by lighting the menorah, which was something else? Except the point is no. The reason why Chazal formulated the mitzvah and enacted the mitzvah that commemorates the war by lighting the menorah, the victory of the war by lighting the menorah, is because that's how the Chashmonaim defined their victory. That's how they finished the day. They didn't consider themselves to be victorious until they lit the menorah. And that was the point where victory had been achieved. If that's how they defined their victory, that's absolutely the way that we define it and commemorate it every year. They ended the war by lighting the menorah. We commemorate the miracle with the war by lighting the menorah. It turns out, therefore, that this aspect, which I think is a very crucial aspect of the story there, it actually emerges from a twinning of the two meanings of Hanukkah. Because Hanukkah, the word refers to inauguration, which means there was an inauguration at some point, but we don't know when it was. But then the second meaning of Hanukkah is Chanukah Hei. They ended the war on the 25th, and we know that's when Hanukkah begins, and that's when the lighting of the menorah began. As if to say, the two meanings of Hanukkah tell us that on the biyom shechanu chinchu, on the day that they rested, that's when they inaugurated. Right, the two go together, and that's really the full meaning of what happened there. And once we look upon it in this way, I think we'll come to a very interesting conclusion or discovery, and that is there is a concept in Hanukkah which is called Mehadrin. Mehadrin people who pursue mitzvahs, as Rashi explained, Mahadran Achar mitzvahs. Why is there a concept of pursuing mitzvahs that is so much a part of Chanukah in a way that we don't find it with other mitzvahs? You can pursue to Mahadran, you can further pursue to Mahadran, Mina Mahadran, but if we understand that the way that we commemorate the miracle of Chanukah reflects the way that the story actually itself happened, and we take our cue from the Chashmonaim were the original Mahadrin Achar HaMitzvahs. They were the ones who pursued mitzvahs. They pursued mitzvahs by using the first available opportunity where they're no longer engaged in battle to go straight to the Beis HaMikdash. That is pursuit of a mitzvah. That's Mahadrin Achar HaMitzvahs. And therefore, in a rather different way than we began, if we say that Mahadrin in the mitzvah is because of what happened, it's perhaps not so much an issue of they were mahader the mitzvahs, they beautified mitzvahs, so we beautified mitzvahs, but they pursued mitzvahs, and that's why we pursue mitzvahs, and we, you have mahadrin achar mitzvahs and mahadrin mina mahadrin achar mitzvahs. I came across in this regard a very interesting comment of the Rokeach. The Rokeach, one of the Ashkenazi Rishonim, known as that group known as Hasidei Ashkenaz, in fact, the 1100s, I believe, and the Rokeach finds many allusions to things, and he talks about the number of candles that you have in Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. You put it all together, you can either, some calculations include the eight shamashes, sometimes exclude the eight shamashes. Excluding it, you go from one to eight, you have 36 candles. And the significance of these 36 candles, says Rokeach, is that they correspond to another 36, almost from the beginning of time. The Gemara tells us, and Midrashim as well, Rashi quotes, that when light was originally created, it was not the light that we have. There was a certain light that had a more elevated quality, but then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after having it in the world for a certain amount of time, he hid it, and that becomes the Or HaGonos. That becomes now known as the concealed light, the Or HaGonos. The Medrash tells us that the Or HaGonos, that original light, it functioned for the first 36 hours of creation. And the Rokeach says the 36 lights that we have on Chanukah correspond to those 36 hours that the Or HaGonos was in operation, before it was then concealed. And as we can appreciate, that is a rather enigmatic statement. What is the difference, more correctly, what is the connection between our Chanukah lights, the Or HaGonos? Our menorah doesn't seem to be particularly gonos, it doesn't seem to be that concealed. There's a mitzvah to publicize it. So how do these two types of lights connect? Interestingly, according to the Malbim, and I believe that his idea can help us here, the Malbim in Parshas Baal Osecha, the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash always relates to the concept of Or HaGonos. There's an interesting pasuk which attracts the attention of many Mefarshim in the beginning of Baal Osecha, and this is the conclusion of the laning. As we know, it's early days yet, but on day 8, right, Zos Chanukah, the final verses of the laning are the beginning of Baal Osecha. And Aaron is told Baal Osecha to kindle the light, so they should go up. And then the pasuk says, "Vayas kein Aaron." Aaron did so, and that, of course, is quite alarming, because if I need the pasuk to tell me that Aaron did what Moshe told him to do, then we're all in trouble, because presumably he did what Moshe told him to do. But the pasuk emphasizes, "Vayas kein Aaron." Rashi comments, and all Mefarshim comment, and the Malbim has a wonderful interpretation of this disarmingly simple pasuk, Vayas Kein Aaron. Actually, when we say that the original light was not the one that endured in the world, there is an allusion in the opening psukim of Bereishis themselves. There is the norm when it comes to things that were created, Hashem says it should be such and such, Totsei Ha'aretz, Tatshei Ha'aretz, whatever it is. Whenever what the Pasuk says, what Hashem said should happen, did happen, it says, Vayihi Chein, as we know. So Hashem said, Totsei Ha'aretz Deshe, Vayihi Chein, Yikov to Ha'aretz, Yikov Ramayim, Seir Abasha, Vayihi Chein. Interestingly, the first thing that was created in that way, through a mimer, explicit words, is light. Vayomer Elokim yehi or. Now, true to form, it should have said, if it says Vayomer Elokim yehi or, it should have said Vayichein, and so it was. But interestingly, as we know, it doesn't say that. It says Vayomer Elokim yehi or, Vayihi or. Why does it not say Vayichein in the way that it does on all the other days? Says the Malbim, because when you say Vayichein, it means, and it was exactly like Hashem said it would be, and that's how it was and remained. But when it comes to the light, that wasn't true, because it was a different light that took over. And that's why when Hashem says Yihi Or, which was the original light, it doesn't say Vayichein, because it didn't remain. Rather, Vayihi Or, there was actually another type of light, because the original light is concealed. Well, we have to ask, if we're allowed, where was it concealed? Or where was it hidden? And the Medrash says, it was written, it was hidden in the Torah. That's where it's concealed. So what does it mean when we say that the original light was hidden in the Torah? No doubt this can be explained on many, many levels, but I think perhaps a basic and meaningful understanding of what that is that, you know, we're familiar with different types of light. What's interesting about different types of light is that when a new type of light comes in, it doesn't really look at anything that wasn't there in the first place. It just looks at it literally in a new light, in a different light. It shows you something, actually, that was always there, but you didn't see it in that light. Which means when you have infrared and you have ultraviolet and whatever it is, they're looking at the same thing. They're not importing new things to look at. It's the same thing, but you were looking at it in a certain light, and here comes a new light, and you see things differently. In a sense, the original light is the correct light with which to see things, through which to see the world. And as we know, you can look at the very same things but not see them in that light. That light was concealed. And the light that we have, we look around and you see whatever it is, events, entities, whatever, you see them in a certain light. But perhaps that's not the ultimate light. Perhaps we give undue emphasis to things that should not really be emphasized. Perhaps we do not give enough emphasis to things that should. That's a question of seeing things in a different light. And where do we come? How do we come to view the world in God's light? It comes from Torah. Because when you look into the Torah and you see what's important and what should be emphasized and what should be prioritized and what is perhaps very impressive but not really of ultimate significance, you begin to look at things in a different light. And one could almost say that the goal of learning Torah is to tap into the world in the light in which it should be looked at and actually take that out and employ it and implement it. The menorah is always a symbol of Torah. Ner mitzvah, v'torah or. And the lighting of the menorah, moreover, I mean, that notion of kindling a light, where you're looking for a different light, that itself gives deeper insight, allows for deeper insight into Torah. And this, says the Malbim, is the deeper understanding of why the Pasuk says about Aaron, Vayas Kein Aaron. Aaron, literally translated, Aaron did thus. But Vayas Kein Aaron means Aaron made the Kein. Which Kein? The Kein that was missing from the original creation of light. It should have said, having said Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, it should have said Vayihi Chein. But it didn't. It says Vayihi Or, because the light that prevailed was a different type of light. Arwen is looking to bring back the cane, as if to say, to provide the implementation for the original light. How does he do that? By lighting the menorah. And what does that do? It petitions for deeper insight and greater understanding of Torah and the light in which to see the world. And the more that happens, the more you allow the world to be viewed in that way, in that light, the more you are providing the cane that was missing at the time. That's what it means to learn Torah, to provide the Vayihi Chen, Vayas Chen Aaron. Well, as we can discuss at length and we have in the past, and referred to as well this evening, I mean, this is the conflict between Greece and Torah. It is literally this question: in what light do you see things? What value do you ascribe to things? How important are certain things as opposed to others? What is the place of success, beauty? How do you define success? It is literally how you look at the world. When the Hashmonaim went to war, because they were not prepared to look at the world in the limited light that Yavan provides, as much as they consider themselves to be enlightened and enlighteners, this is why they were rewarded with light itself, with the miracle of that the oil lasted longer, which to provide further illumination, the type of which we feel is important, which is of ultimate significance and not temporal or political mundane significance. And perhaps this can give us some level of insight into that comment of the Rokeach. The 36 candles, the 36 lights of Hanukkah, they correspond to the 36 hours that the Or HaGonos was in operation. We're looking to parallel those 36 hours because we're looking to access that light, although it's largely been hidden, but we're looking to uncover it. We're looking to bring it out. And the way that that happens is by first and foremost celebrating the fact that we were not prepared to settle for the limited light that Yavan provided, but rather we're looking for the ultimate light to which the Torah provides, took the measures to restore that and to promote and to develop it, and that remains the charge and the challenge and the message of the primary messages, I believe, of Hanukkah every year. I mean, the Hanukkah is not limited to the 8 days of the year. These are 8 days that should themselves shed light, shall we say, on the rest of the year. And the more we appreciate the significance of these concepts, Mirtz Hashem, the more we will get out of these special days, beginning tomorrow evening. We should have a lichtige Chanukah, and there should be a chizuk, in fact, for the entire year. We'll leave it over there for this.